Welcome to ACB Radio's Main Menu Live. Opinions expressed during the show do not reflect the views of ACB Radio or the American Council of the Blind, its members, employees, or board of directors. If you would like to participate in the live show at 2 hours Universal on Wednesdays, please call toll-free 866-400-5333. That's 866-400-5333.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, and welcome to Main Menu Live this week. That's right, we're live for the next 2 hours here on ACB Radio Interact. We're not on Interactive. That's normally on Friday night, Saturday mornings. I'm sorry about that. We're here on ACB Radio Mainstream here with Main Menu Live, and tonight we have a number of guests with us tonight. But before we get into that, let me bring on my co-host with me, who has all of our Skype guests present with us. Hello, Daryl. How's it going?
It's going well, and I believe everybody is here and accounted for, and we're ready for a great show.
Excellent, excellent. All right. Well, before we get into tonight's topics, we have a number of items that we want to mention. First of all, we want to mention how can everyone get a hold of us tonight, and you can call 866-400-JEFF, 866-400-5333. We have Windows Live Messenger, and Daryl, do you have that going tonight?
Yes, it's the address to add to your MSN Windows Live Messenger contact list is mainmenu@acbradio.org. That's mainmenu@acbradio.org.
Great, okay. And we've added a new thing to the show, that being Twitter. And you can get to that. You want to give them that information, Daryl?
Yes, certainly. There's two approaches to that. You can go to twitter.com/mainmenu. That's twitter.com/mainmenu. And you also can access the updates through the Main Menu blog over at mainmenu.acbradio.org.
All right, great. Okay. And let's get into a few, we only have a few things this week in reference to technology news. And we'll start with the one that seems to be getting everyone excited this week, that being the JAWS for Windows 9.0 Public Beta 1 is now available. You can head over to www.freedomscientific.com under the software section, and you can download that public beta. There are a number of new fixes in it, and they're looking for your feedback. One of the things that we would encourage you to do is to make sure that if you're going to download the beta and play with it, if you encounter any issues, please, please let them know of any issues and fill out that form, because there's, you know, if you're going to post to a mailing list, that really isn't going to do them any good. You know, they need the information that goes directly to them, directly to their software engineers, to get that stuff fixed.
Posts to mailing lists and blogs are wonderful, but yes, it doesn't substitute for sending the feedback directly to Freedom Scientific.
That's right. Code Factory, you want to do yours next?
Okay, yeah, certainly. Okay, well, it seems that Benetech, the founders of Bookshare.org, have just received a $32 million grant from the U.S. Department of Education to be funded over the next 5 years.
Yeah.
And this means that Bookshare.org is now free to schools and to all K-12 and post-secondary students in the USA. Bookshare is free to them. And also, over the next... while they plan to add at least 100,000 new items to the collection.
That's going to be great for students, and I'm wondering if they're going to open it up to professors and staff of, you know, universities, as well as blind teachers.
It says schools and students, so yeah. You might want to check that out there, Jeff.
Yeah, it would be very interesting. I'll have to. there you go. Yeah, Jeff. Although their staff, although I don't mind contributing my $50 a year.
It's not.
Bookshare.
You know what?
Hey.
For the deal, for the service that they offer, I would highly encourage you, even if you are a student and maybe technically eligible, you know, donate something to them.
Exactly.
You get 100 books a month.
Yeah, where else can you buy 100 bestseller books for 50¢ a piece? For the
yeah.
And that's for the entire year subscription rate. So you do the math. It's like a nickel a piece or something.
Yeah, and it's you know, yes, they are scanned, but most of the books are quite readable. And look, they offer a service that that nobody else offers out there.
That's right. Let's move on to our next story. Code Factory. This is an extremely exciting announcement because I'm actually looking at switching cell phones and actually screen readers for my cell phone. So I was delighted when I saw this. They are moving to a user subscription model. Formerly, they would tie the license to the phone. So if you got a new phone, then you'd have to pay a nominal fee to get a new version of the screen reader from Code Factory to be able to be put it. To put it on your phone. Well, that's not the case anymore. It's now tied to the individual. So if you want to switch phones every week, then it's not going to cost you anymore. So that's great. And 2.0 versions of their products are coming out, both for Symbian and for Windows Mobile, very soon. And we'll actually have more information on that coming up in the, not in the near future, but in a little bit later this year, we'll have some more information on all things going on at Code Factory. We already... We actually took a call about that today, and we have that in the works. So we're excited about that. We're got that scheduled out near the holidays, actually. So, all right.
Looks like there's some challenges on the book port front. For those of you who own an APH book port, portable electronic book reading device, looks like book port 2 is not going to be released anytime in the near future due to some hardware vendor related issues, and it also appears that there is not going to be a way for the current model of the book port to read NLS compatible books. Seems they wanted to add the support into the book port transfer software, and then since the book port does not have the proper codec on board, and then translate the books across in an MP3 format, and NLS could not get that worked out. So on the book port front, that's the story, and that is just recently made public. And any questions on that could go to the book port mailing list or directly to the American Printing House for the Blind at aph.org.
Yeah, you can pick up the phone and give them a call. They have an 800 number, and
yep.
You can, 221-1839 or something like that. I know it's 1839, I think, at the end, but check at hph.org for the phone number, and if you want to give them a call and talk to them. All right, well, that kind of wraps it up for technology news this week, and now we'll get right into our topic, and let me warmly welcome a number of people here tonight, and we'll first start with Ray Bronk. Ray Bronk is a gentleman who worked with me at Microsoft/Keen/Convergys, one of those types of situations where you start with one company, end up with three. and he did technical support for Microsoft and did a really bang up job of that. But more importantly, Ray Bronk is my my blind tech. No, he is really deep into hardware, and a lot more so than I am. I won't touch the stuff. So this is why we're bringing on a number of people to talk to all of you about hardware and that type of thing. And you know, we've actually had a number of people who have emailed us when we've brought up hardware and asked a number of questions to us, and so we thought, well, we want to do a whole show about it. You know, what kind of things do you want to do to prepare for a hardware upgrade? I can assume all of you that are listening tonight have a computer, so this is really kind of geared toward those people who are upgrading. What kind of things do you want to do to prepare for that upgrade as far as software and hardware and making sure you have all of your software keys and all that? We'll get into all of those details. But let me warmly welcome Ray Bronk. Hello, Ray. How's it going?
Hey, pretty good there, Jeff. And hi, gang.
That's right. He's actually sitting right over here. He just finished his Subway. Did you have a meatball sub there, Ray?
Yeah, it was a meatball sub. It's pretty good.
There you go. That's right.
Yeah, there you go.
That's right.
Hello, Daryl.
You got to fill the tummy of the guest.
That's right.
And make me wait until after the show to eat.
It's amazing. I came over and there was nothing to be fixed.
Yes, this is amazing.
When
we talked last night, just to make sure things are all ready to go, he says, "Well, do I need to bring anything over? Is everything working?" Yes, everything's working. This is very, very rare for us. Next, I'd like to welcome Slick to the show. Now, Slick is another person who worked with us as well. Slick is someone who definitely delves into both the software and the hardware realm. I'm not really sure what to think of Slick anymore because he has a Mac at his house. I'm just kidding.
Nobody
just kidding,
knows
Slick.
What to think of me.
I'm just kidding. He's borrowing a Mac and he's playing with it. And so I wanted to welcome you, Slick. How's it going?
You say borrow like I'm going to give it back.
Well, you better give it back to Andy. Slick
no,
is...
No, I don't have to give it back to Andy. Wait a minute.
You don't have to give it back.
Wait a minute.
I hope Andy's listening.
I'm actually evaluating it this week, so...
Oh, good. That's great. Slick is a participant in a show that's over at TechTalkRadio.com, and it's a weekly show. It's a two-hour technology show, kind of similar to Main Menu, except it's more geared toward the mainstream market. And but we asked him, and he said, "Hey, sure, I'll come on." And it's too bad you're not over here, Slick. Unfortunately, I don't have a third mic because we would have fed you too.
Obviously, I'm on the wrong program because apparently people who participate in your program they get to eat.
Well, that's what I was just going to say. You're not over here, or else I would have. But Ray's the only one over here, so. But I haven't even eaten yet. So.
I'll be right over.
All right. Well, great. if you can find me, you're welcome to it. All right, and let's see now. Welcome Randy Knapp. Hello, Randy. How's it going?
Yeah, it's going very well, Jeff. And I also wanted to take an opportunity, while this is not strictly technology related, to congratulate the Arizona Diamondbacks on a postseason appearance.
Thank God.
And you can also congratulate the fact that my Cleveland Indians did the same.
Yeah, that's right. And let's just hope and pray we don't have to play the Colorado Rockies, because if they play like they did last night, we're in real trouble.
Right.
Yeah. Now, Randy, you do quite a bit with hardware too, and you and your sidekick Cliff there, and so this is kind of why we asked you to come on board too. And you and I've been bantering about you know, talking about what we want to do for upgrades and that type of thing. And then finally, it's Rick Harmon. Hello, Rick. How's it going?
Hello, Jeff. How are you?
Oh, good. You're real low, though. Maybe you want to... I don't know if you can bring up your audio there or not.
I'm having a problem.
Oh, okay. We'll see what we can do to help you there. Okay.
Skype trademark dash.
We're hearing your speech over there, Rick. Okay, we'll let you try to sort that out, and then we'll kind of go from there. All right. Well, let's get started by talking a little bit about upgrading a little bit from a software perspective. And I think this is really kind of important because it's an area that a lot of people don't really think about too much. And in reference to making sure you have all of things that are necessary. And let's start with Randy, and then we'll pass it over to Slick, and then we'll pass it over to Ray. And I want to get your ideas, guys, on what do you feel is let's kind of hold off on backups for a minute, because actually we have a number of questions in that area. But what kind of things are you guys doing in reference to, you know, let's say you just bought a new motherboard and the whole bit, and you're ready to do an upgrade. What kind of things are you doing at the software level to prepare for that?
Well, the first thing I do is I try to make a decision about when I'm going to be upgrading, what operating system I plan on using. Because if it's the same operating system that I'm migrating, then I then it's likely that what I would probably do would be I would probably load the new operating system with its drivers and then migrate data files. Sometimes if I'm fortunate enough, systems are such that they both use the same INF drivers in the same chipset, then so if I say I'm going from one motherboard to another that's identical in its architecture, you then can just take an image and drop the image and save yourself a lot of time and trouble. But otherwise, if it's not that, then basically my focus would be to determine what operating systems I would need, certainly make sure I got all my data files, and I would also make certain that any software that was really important to me would be available either in an installable form or in some way that I could retrieve it.
Okay, good. Now, this brings up a really important point that I want to make sure we go to now in case it's forgotten. And Slick, this has actually come up on your guys' show a number of times where people have upgraded and they have not done this, meaning that they have not started from scratch with an operating system. Have you ever upgraded a system, Slick, where you have used pretty much the identical board, and have you run into problems with that?
No, can't say that I have. Every board that I personally have done has been different one way or another, whether it be make or model. But I have worked with people where they said, you know, hey, this is the third board, same manufacturer, exact same model, exact same revision, and I got this problem.
Right.
I usually start when it comes to I usually start with compatibility. I look to see whether or not it's going to work is another question. The first question I ask is, did this manufacturer and this manufacturer say that they are supposed to work together? Now, if they say no, you know, doesn't mean you have to stop. You can keep going, but you need to face that up front. A lot of people don't want to.
Yeah, yeah. Now, what about drivers, though? I mean, I had a situation where we stuck a board in that you know, said it was exactly the same model of board, and we ran into driver issues. So do you think it's safe that if you're basically just swapping out the board to just, you know, put the board in and reboot the Windows box, or is it safer to do a reinstall of the OS, or what do you think?
I say you can go with plan A, but also have plan B. Plan A is, you know, pop it in there, and if it works, great.
Yeah.
However, be prepared for plan
exactly.
B.
Exactly. Now, in this case, Ray, what do you think?
I something that hasn't been covered yet. If you've got a pre-manufactured machine, let's say a Dell or a Sony or whatever, a Gateway, and you're doing some upgrades on it, you've got to make sure, first of all, you go back to the manufacturer and make sure whatever upgrades are compatible, software and hardware, because they're going to know their machine better than you do. The other way around it, of course, if it's a hardware issue, if it's of the same same make, you could probably you might be able to get away with it. But as a rule, you're more than likely going to have to reinstall the OS. It's just safer in the long run.
Okay.
But then of course you got to do the backup stuff too.
Go ahead, Randy.
The other issue you may run into is that while your board model and manufacturing numbers are the same, you may have BIOS revisions, and some BIOS revisions are major. And
great point.
When that happens, that can really goof with things. So that's another thing to sort of consider.
That's very
when you're
interesting.
Doing that.
Now, Daryl, when you have done upgrades and stuff like that, what have you done to protect things like software keys, registration keys, and things like that? Do you have any good suggestions in that area?
Well, when I get new software, if there's a CD, one of those product keys, then I write it down as soon as I have it read to me.
Right.
And I back those files up. Nowadays, I put them on a thumb drive or external hard drive. And back them up along with my other, non-system/software data.
Okay.
And so I have those when I'm ready to install the software. I can also used and have used BellARC Advisor.
Yes, I was hoping someone was going to bring that up.
Oh, yeah.
BellARC, BellARC.com. It's free. One of the things that it will tell you about your system is all the product license keys that are installed.
Yeah, mainly of the mainstream products, Microsoft Office, your Windows product
right.
key, and stuff like that. A lot of shareware or tools like that that don't register their keys in the registry, you're probably not going to have a chance to get at that information. Rick, are you back with us?
No, not yet.
Okay.
He's not back
he
yet.
Is, he's still working on stuff. Okay. All right. Well, now we mentioned I want to move to backup strategies because obviously before you even consider potentially starting from scratch, we want to talk about backup strategies. And we actually have a question from a user, but we'll get to that in just a minute. And you know, there's a lot of really interesting strategies that one can undertake in reference to backup strategies. And let's see what our panel of experts thinks in reference to what the most reliable method of backups is. And please don't mention a Colorado backup tape drive, please. Nothing like that. I think I've had enough of noises in
gone
my life.
Gone are the days of those. Yeah.
Oh yes, and yes, that was those days were fun. So let's start with Slick, and then we'll go to Randy, and then we'll go to Ray there. Go ahead, Slick.
Backup strategy.
Yeah.
In my personal experience, I don't trust anything more than myself. Period. End of story. I mean, I'm not saying anything bad about the software. You know, other software that's out there, and other services. However, they don't always get everything that I want.
Well, that's very interesting. So, when you say what you want, when you back up, what do you back up? Do you just back up data?
Well,
do you back
up? You know, most people will go for, I guess, the easy, you'll look at your documents and settings folder and that kind of thing. I also personalize a lot of things. I mean, I'll have a folder off the root of the C drive that the backup software doesn't even know about. They just go, all right, I'll grab things out of your program files folder, maybe out of your documents and settings folder, and I'm done.
Right, right. Well, one of the things that I do is I move all of my mail to a different folder than the defaults. So, for example, if you're using Outlook Express, you can click on the Maintenance tab, and you can change the location of where all of your DBX files are stored. And I have a folder called Mail, and under that I have an Outlook folder. That's where I keep all of my PSTs, and an OE folder, and that's where all of the Outlook Express stuff is kept, including my address book. So at least I make a copy of that file there about every week or so to make sure that it stays there. The Windows.
Do some recovery file. Experiences that I've had. I've gotten to the habit of. I mean, right now, the first thing I do when with a computer is I create right off the root of the C drive just a folder with my name on it. Slick.
Yeah.
All data goes there, believe it or not. I mean, I don't keep anything in documents and settings. I really don't. If I keep it in documents and settings or whatever, I expect to lose it. I just plan on losing it.
Yeah, exactly.
Because
yeah.
I have put in those recovery CDs.
Well, yeah. not only that, if your profile becomes corrupt, there's a very high probability that that's going to end up wiping out that as well. Because
I had a situation the other day where I was able to boot with an Ubuntu CD and get everything off the drive because I knew everything was.
Yeah, excellent. Now, what are you backing up to, Slick? Are you using CDs? What are you using?
I'm a huge fan of external drives. I've got I had 2 terabytes sitting here in front of me a while ago. Yes, I have that much crap.
2 terabytes. Wow.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, that's a lot.
That must be nice.
Right now, I mean. I learned a bad lesson. I'll tell you one thing about these large terabyte drives. One thing that I didn't realize when I purchased my very first terabyte drive was inside the box. I didn't read everything. There were 2 500s, and the way it was a RAID 0, and it went bad. So then I could not salvage the data. I actually had to take it over to a store and have them pull the data off the drives and then separate the drives. I mean, it cost me a couple hundred. I learned my lesson the hard way on that one.
Wow, that's interesting. Okay, Randy, what do you think about backup strategy and that type of thing?
Well, there's a software program, and I can't. It'll come to me before the end of this evening, I hope. But basically, it does part of its backup strategy is it allows anything that you back up to be stored in compressed zip files. And so,
yeah, I think this was mentioned on the show. Yeah, this was mentioned on a show a couple weeks ago.
And I like that. And they just come out with a new version of that software that has disaster backup, which was my only criticism of the program. So now my criticism of late. So that's basically what I like to do. I'll do an image once a month, and then I'm not quite as you know, I haven't gone to the trouble of trying to worry about whether it's going to disappear from documents and settings in my documents. So I just routinely back that whole area up once a week.
Okay.
But I mean that's pretty well what I do, and I also use a large hard disk, and the reason for it is simply because I'm too lazy to swap CDs, and besides, about the time you're into a real flow and you really need something to happen, you'll burn a coaster. So
yeah.
There's your backup.
Yeah, no kidding.
So I that's sort of the way I've decided to go.
Yeah. Now, Ray, you seem to keep your pulse on all things in reference to cost of things a lot lately, and so we've talked a lot about hard drives. It's incredible. In fact, you mentioned this to me a couple weeks ago, how significantly the price of hard drives, both internal and external, have come down.
Well, yeah, 500 gig hard drive for 100 and a quarter. Well, I mean that's
yeah.
Couldn't even have thought of that even a year ago.
I saw one at Tiger Direct. I got a mailing on 2 days ago, 500 gig for $99.
Yeah. Well,
I saw that.
Yeah. Even if it is 100, I think it was like 114 on Newegg is what I was looking at. But so what? I mean, it's kind of relative there. As far as the backups go, I handle it kind of a two-pronged approach. What I'll do is I'll take all the drivers and so forth, and I'll make up a CD with all the drivers for the motherboard, as well as other programs that I will install. So if I'm doing a plain install, a blank install, you know, starting from scratch, that way I have everything there in front of me. Now, as far as the other stuff goes, I do have a different hard drive that I can just throw in the machine, and I guess I should get lazy and go out and buy an outboard hard drive cage and just stick the hard drive in it. But that way I can keep everything backed up that way, and I try to do that pretty often, so that's how I handle it.
Okay, good. Let's see. Daryl, have you heard from Rick? Oh, wait, hold on. Daryl, have you heard from Rick?
Yep.
Is Rick back?
Yes, sir.
All right, great.
Hey.
All right, good, you're back. Good, all right. So we want to get your feedback on these two items so far, Rick, since you were away there for a little bit. We talked a little bit about just preparation. And you just went through this process, a little bit anyway. And so you want to give us your ideas both on software prep as well as your backup strategy.
Okay, well, on software prep, you definitely want to make sure you have every single driver that you need for either your current system or your new system. And you know, all your programs you're going to need, especially your system technology and your Windows and all that good stuff. As far as backups, I typically back up, I kind of cross back up from one computer to the other, and I also use external storage as well.
Okay, good. Now, Sue has emailed us and asked us, she's interested in an external DVD burner or CD burner, and she likes the portability of that so that she can take it around and either back up things with it or or just take CD or DVDs with her. And have any of you had any experience with portable DVD drives, DVD burners?
Back in the parallel port days.
Yeah, I was going to say, I have not seen...
No.
I have not seen many portable DVDs.
I've used the FireWire one.
You've used the FireWire one?
Most of the time. Most of the time on those, they're pretty much... you more or less think of those if you're using a laptop or a notebook that doesn't have room for a writer.
Yeah.
Then you've got the portable CD.
I would think one would want to just go with a portable drive. And
I think you're better off in the long run.
Yeah.
Now, a DVD drive, I suppose, you know, if you want to back it up, just folder to folder type of deal, that's one thing. If it's something that you're going to keep on a long-term basis, but...
Hey, Ray.
Yes?
I have two words for you. Blu-ray.
Expensive.
Well, I don't think so. I mean, not in my opinion now. I mean, I've seen them down in the $300 range, and I'm waiting for them to come down to two. Yeah. I like Blu-ray.
That's too expensive.
It's still expensive. But when you go out and buy a DVD, a regular DVD drive for $35, so, you know, that's expensive.
And that's a DVD burner, too.
That's a burner, you know.
Yeah, man, I remember when floppies were $100.
Oh, yeah. And now you can buy floppy drives for $5. I was looking at the other day, I go, oh, my God.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. All right. Okay. Well, now this gets us into the actual discussion about what guts do you want in your system. And I think we should really, I'll take some advice on this from the rest of you, but... I think it would be best to start out with just talking a little bit about some concepts about hardware in general, so that, you know, if you're wanting to rebuild a system, at least you're familiar with some of the most recent terminology. And let's go ahead and start with Randy, and then we'll pass it over to Rick. And kind of what I'm looking at here is, if you were to be going up to Newegg, and you were looking, Newegg is just an example, and we'll get to the accessibility of Newegg's website here in a minute, but we'll take that call in just a minute. But what kind of things should one be aware of in reference to, you know, the types of motherboards that are out there, AMD versus Intel? The different socket type technologies, as well as some of the stuff that you're going to see on the motherboard, and some of the geeky terms that are being floated out there. So I'll let Randy kick it off, and then we'll toss it over to Rick, and then we'll let Ray step in, and then Slick, and then we'll pass it over to Daryl. By the way, Daryl, let us know if we ever get any IM questions. All right?
Yeah, we haven't yet.
Okay, and I'll check on this caller. And so go ahead and kick it off, Randy.
Well, there's a couple of different schools of thought, so I think what I'll do is toss them both out on the table, and then we can all knock them around a little bit. The first school of thought says any computer you buy, you'll be lucky to get 3 years out of before you do it again. So therefore, spending a whole lot of money to do a high-end solution, maybe money that you don't recoup so easily 3 years down the road, because even the high-end solution becomes dated. And then there's another school of philosophy that says you make certain that you design your system around the tasks you typically perform and how long you expect to keep the computer, and to the extent to which you want that computer to be expandable. And finally, there's also the issue of what manufacturer's processor you're going to use, which chipset manufacturer you're going to employ. And I never thought I'd ever say this, but these days, even the number of slots on the motherboard can be debated, because the dependence on slots these days is not what it once was. So I think one can really feasibly look at a smaller size three-slot motherboard in many applications, and have that be sufficient. Having said all that, in my own choices, I've tended to be a little more champagne-oriented in the sense that I really try to take a look at the operating system I'm running, the memory requirements of the operating system, what my applications are going to run, what the price performance ratio is at for things like dual core and quad core processors and things of this sort. And then after weighing all of this, I try to spend enough money that I can reasonably expect to get 5 years out of a system. So I tend to buy a little more high end than I think some folks would.
Yeah, good. Okay. And Randy, when you're looking at when you're actually shopping around and looking at chipsets and things like that, is that as important as it used to be? I mean, this used to actually be a very big issue. Is it as important anymore, or is it? I mean, for example, if you go Intel, I mean, obviously the chipset variation is significant. Do you find that to be something that one needs to be concerned about, both from an accessibility standpoint as well as just the stability and you know, just overall performance standpoint?
I'm more influenced anymore by the manufacturer of the motherboard than I am by the chipset, because in most cases, at least, and I'm sure we can all point to exceptions to this, but you know, both AMD and Intel, being manufacturers of processors these days, are really doing solid jobs of implementing their core stuff, and the chipsets that are developed to support them, I think, are also reasonably stable. So I don't think that's as much of an issue as it once was. But when it comes down to things like accessibility, there are some motherboard manufacturers, for example, that have in their BIOSes talking diagnostics.
Right.
So that,
and actually, Randy, your timing is excellent on that, because we have a caller on exactly that subject. And this is sort of where I wanted to actually lead you to. Welcome, Danny, to Main Menu Live. And we're speaking to Randy right now about hardware and that type of a thing. And you had a question about boards that talk. And
yes.
Why don't you go ahead and ask your question, and then we'll let you listen on the air, okay?
Yes, thank you. I wanted to know how in the world could I find a main board manufacturer that makes a board which can give me any kind of talking feedback in any way. I don't know whether I really want to build a computer yet or whether I want someone to build it, because I'm wanting to get a computer, and I haven't gotten one in a very long time, and I don't know what's out there or where to begin. So I appreciate whatever you have to say on that.
Okay, great. We'll let you listen.
Thank you.
We'll let you listen on the air, okay?
All right, thank you.
All right, Danny. All right. Now, you and I have talked about this extensively, actually, Randy, and so tell us about this board that I know you're going to probably buy the next one of, right?
Right. I think there are many good, solid motherboard manufacturers out there that do very credible jobs, and depending on reviews you read and you know, who's doing what in the moment, I mean, one can argue that this kind of ebbs and flows as the industry ebbs and flows, but one of the features that ASUS has in some of their higher-end motherboards is they have a feature in their BIOS that allows the end user to know that the memory check was done successfully and that the computer is going to boot from the operating system. And you may say, well, why would you need that smoking? You would just know. Well, what if I didn't plug a keyboard in? Or what if I did something really stupid? And, you know, a lot of us that think about, you know, potentially complicated issues can oftentimes get tripped over things such as, well, gee, is there power to the computer? So my point being that having some way of getting some audible feedback about what your system's doing, and at least to the extent that it can tell you where it's gone, may give you an ability to troubleshoot a situation as it arises. And so when I'm buying for myself, that's a feature that I find very valuable, and I try to buy motherboards that will support that. Now, there may be other manufacturers that do this as well. I'm familiar with ASUS doing it in their motherboards, but that is something that for me I have found to be very, very useful, especially when I'm responsible for a lab of 10 computers, and somebody invariably pulls a keyboard out. At least I know why the system's not coming up.
Yeah. Now, Ray, Rick, And Daryl, have any of you heard of any other boards that support that type of technology?
The only thing I've seen is just not so much talking technology, but more or less they'll have lights, which of course doesn't do me any good, or they'll have some audible
beeps
to indicate what's going on, and if you know what those are, that's great.
Yeah. But unfortunately, they're in the printed manual or in a scanned PDF that doesn't scan well.
Yeah, so then you call the manufacturer and you tell them, well, I'm a totally blind person and I've got to find out, does this do this and that? And so then you got to deal with their attitudes for a few minutes until they totally understand you're serious.
Or you can play Morse code and have them try to figure it out.
Yeah.
Here, this is coming from my motherboard. Can you tell me what this is? That would be pretty funny. Okay. All right, Rick. Now you have just had an opportunity to buy a board. Is this something that you've considered in reference to a board that may give you some audible feedback?
I considered it to some extent. My old Asus P4B motherboard on a system I built back in 2002 when I still had sight had that feature. And matter of fact, I still had the system. And yeah, it's very interesting to have that functionality because it tells you if you fail your power on self-test, you know, all kinds of good things like that. Yes, it was a consideration, but I just ended up not going with the Asus board this time, so.
Okay. Now the one thing to really keep in mind is, and I think I am correct on this, that it will not speak the setup process inside of CMOS, correct,
no.
Guys?
That is correct.
Okay. Has anyone found any resolution to that, an accessible resolution to that? Go ahead, Ray.
Just a pair of eyes.
Yeah, yeah.
Around
yeah,
it.
That's it really...
There is... I've heard of something. I don't know if anybody's played with it. It's called PC Weasel. Has anybody tried that?
Oh, boy. That sounds kind of dangerous.
It's a PC card that you install into your system, and then it has a serial port or something that you can plug in, another computer or anything with a terminal emulator, and it'll
send the
output.
I've heard of people hooking up external synthesizers to their serial ports, and actually getting it to, you know, talk the CMOS screens. But you know, a lot of these now are so graphical.
Yeah.
They're not just straight text anymore. I mean,
no.
You know, I mean, Slick, you've probably seen a lot of CMOS screens and. It probably is a pretty foregone conclusion that the days of a nice little menu, a text menu with numbers and things are long gone, huh?
Yeah. Didn't we have this conversation about accessibility about a week or two ago where I'm just as, and you know, I have sight and I'm just as amazed that these people would put stuff available on the internet that's not accessible. To me, that's stupid. I don't know why I get so angry about it. I just think it's ridiculous.
Well,
it's crazy.
We need more sighted people to get angry like that. That'd be good.
Exactly. Yep.
But it just doesn't make any common sense to me. I don't understand.
Well, what about the CMOS windows though? I mean, aren't a lot of these are now mouse driven? They have mouse support built into the window.
You can still use keys.
Awards are still text based.
Yeah, they're still.
Oh, awards is okay.
Yeah.
I know many of them are not though. Many of them are graphical
in
nature. Yeah,
but there's still a lot of them that are.
Well, that's good because, you know, if you got creative, you might be able to get it redirected somehow. Although I'm not sure that's possible as much today as it was.
I didn't think the PC Weasel worked anymore. I thought that was an ISA card.
It may not. I've heard that there is a PCI version, but
okay, good. Well, let's kind of get back into this topic of the different types of hardware out there and just to make sure that people know when they're going out and buying this stuff. Slick, why don't you take a crack at describing both? Let's not go too far back, because you know we can go back into the 80s here or further. But can you kind of describe for us the difference between, PCI, you know, and go back a little bit further, and both the and PCI Express and that type of thing. Are you feel pretty comfortable with that stuff?
not really. I'll tell you why. Because I don't try. I've never been a big hardware head. I started out as a user and wound up being trained in the art of troubleshooting. That's my specialty. It's like, we got this problem. All right, let me see if I can help you fix it.
Right. Okay.
As far as hardware goes, PCI and the ports and expresses, the buses, not my specialty. Without
doing a little research,
paperwork in front of me.
Yeah. Okay. That's fine. I know, Randy, you've dealt a lot with this, and you go very far back. Do you kind of want to touch a little bit on this?
I think the real issue that you deal with in terms of looking at the hardware progression is the way in which this data over buses are handled. As you progressed all the way up through what's current, you're really talking about data path and how much faster data can flow through a computer. I recently bought a new external hard drive that was an ATA hard drive, and I put it in a box that worked, that not only had a USB output for a connection, but also had a serial ATA external output, and the difference, guys, is extreme in terms of data throughput and transfer. So, I mean, I think that's really what you're looking at, if you're going to have these processors that can chunk out data much quicker, it's got to have some place to stick that data, and the buses have to be able to accommodate that data. And I think that's what you're seeing is a much faster sharing and transferring of data. And I think that's also what you see when you get into these dual-core and quad-core processors from the consumer's point of view, is that, you know, tasks that like to eat up CPU cycles, like antiviruses, you know, ET calling home to check to see if there's any new updates, don't, you know, your system kind of doesn't even flinch when it does this on a dual core system, whereas on a single core system, you know, those of you that use certain screen readers that we know and love find that sometimes they just take a moment to pause and reflect on their state of being for about 45 seconds.
Yeah, well, frankly, they all do
cycle
it. Frankly, they all do it. So no matter what screen reader you get, they all.
Hey, you know what? Even on my dual core system, it still happens occasionally. Not nearly as often, but still happens.
Well, Daryl and I were discussing this last night because I was having extreme frustration with I think a situation that may have been resolved by a dual core system. So now, Rick, you before you went blind, you delved in a lot of computer stuff, and obviously from reading your website.
Yes. I started building PCs back in 1985, so I go way, way back.
Yeah. So what are you seeing in reference to, you know, obviously people don't want to buy a system that's based on ISA slots, right? I mean, that's not. I don't even know if you can get slots on the board that would support an older card like that. Are there?
No,
not anymore.
Not anything new.
No, but what is strange is the system and the system software for like XP, and you see ISA, that's still a throwback.
Yeah, now is that true in Vista, though, too, Rick? Did they ship ISA drivers in Vista?
That I'm not sure. I'd have to look.
Yeah, that would be interesting. Because you kind of wonder if they, well, you kind of wonder if how much faster it would make things if they unloaded that payload from the operating system. That would be rather interesting.
Well, that wouldn't worry, Jeff. Even if they did that, Microsoft would find another way to slow it down.
Well, that pretty much goes without saying. So. Let's see. Can you talk to us a little bit about PCI Express versus PCI, Rick? And is that something that do you want to look for a board that supports mainly Express, or, you know, really when you're looking for a motherboard, what type of slots are you really wanting to make sure that you have, and are there advantages and disadvantages either way? And I'll get the call. We have a new call.
Well, most of the new systems that have come out over the last 2 years have migrated more and more towards PCI Express and PCI Express 16. My current system has three regular legacy PCI slots. It has two what they call PCI Express slots, and it has one PCI Express 16 slot. Now, you know, if say you were a sighted person, you're looking for things like PCI Express 16 for video because it's incredibly fast. You know, the days of AGP are gone. You know, you're going to put a video card in your system. You definitely want, you know, PCI Express 16. And the high-end gamers and stuff, you know, want two of them, you know, so they can put two cards in and cross-link them. So, you know, the days of AGP, ISA, things like that, they're all gone. You know, everything's just going faster and faster and faster now.
Now, are there any tactile differences between, obviously, there were tactile differences between PCI and ISA, but are there any tactile differences between the various varieties of ISA slots?
Yes. Yeah, the PCI Express slots are a little shorter, I believe, than the PCI standard slots. And the PCI Express 16s are even longer.
Almost about the same size.
PCIs. Yeah, that brings up a really good point. When you're holding a card in your hand, let's say you're beginning to put the system together, is there really a good way to differentiate, you know, this is an AGP card, this is a PCI card, this is a PCI Express card? I think PCI Express is the latest, right?
Yes.
Or is there something newer? God, there probably is, but I don't know what it is.
No, the PCI Express and the PCI Express 16s are the newest.
Okay.
Well, I guess the first question is, I mean, the first thing we ought to look at before we even look at the cards is, how much of what you would normally put in slots are already built on these motherboards?
Yeah, and is that an advantage?
In some cases, yes. In some cases, no.
Okay. Let's hold on to that thought just for a second. We do have a caller, and let's bring the caller in, and then we'll go back to that question of, do you want everything on the motherboard? That's a great question, and I have an opinion on it, but it will be interesting to see what others think. Hello, Richard, and welcome to Main Menu Live. You had a question about your Sony laptop.
Yeah, I have a it's a fairly good machine. It's an 800 megahertz processor with 512 of RAM. That was the max of RAM I could put into it. But it's running me, and I'm finally having some real issues with me, so I'm deciding, well, I'm going to pull out the hard drive, put in a new one, and upgrade to XP.
Yeah.
The only problem I'm having, when I called the company about, you know, the drive, the person I talked to was, I didn't think was really too swift to begin with, and the person came back to me and said, well, you can only put in the original hardware, 20 gig, and they wanted $250 for the drive.
Now,
I found through Jerry Richard a 60 gig hard drive for $110, but the only problem is I've got to be sure that I can stuff it in the machine and go. And I had the serial number and the model number of the laptop, and he's checking that all out for me. But that seems to be the issue, I think, with some of these companies. When you know what you want and you're trying to ask for somebody, and you get these tech people that are just absolutely, you know, they have a script and they can't deviate from the script.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you, Richard, before we let you go here, and you can listen on the air, but can you tell us the processor that's in that laptop now? Do you know?
I think it's a Pentium 800 megahertz.
Okay.
You know, it's pretty, mobile or pretty something? It's a pretty standard
Still running Windows
Millennium.
Yeah, running Windows, running Windows Millennium. Okay. Richard, we're going to let you listen on the air, and we'll take this off and see what our panel thinks.
Thanks.
Okay. All right, guys. What do you guys think of Richard's machine there?
I would say this. I would say that I had Vista, XP. goodness, on a machine, on a 700 megahertz machine. Now, it had 256 meg of RAM, but, you know, it was one that Karen used for a while. It was kind of slow, and I'm not sure that going up to 512 on 800 megahertz is... Vista will run, but...
You wouldn't want to do that.
XP will run, but it will be slow.
Yeah.
My concern is the controller, because laptops are a bit of a different animal, and most times, even with today's laptops, if you're looking at laptops where you have options for the kinds of hard drives you want to put in them, the spec will tell you the capacity of the controller, and some can handle 160 gig, some can handle 200 gig. In the day that thing was built, it may not handle more than 20 gig. I'd be careful.
Yeah, no matter what the operating system supports, right? I mean,
this really
could be a...
It can be a bias issue.
I'd absolutely be careful.
Yeah, I agree. More so on a laptop than a desktop. The bias is on the laptops. Things change. It's more radical than a desktop.
Yeah.
You can probably get a larger hard drive, larger gig size hard drive. It'll probably be the same physical size, and it'll probably fit in there. But whether it will work to the full potential, you might have to partition it out a bunch to do it.
What about hooking up an external via USB? Is that still going to be an issue?
Still can.
Well, because you're going to have, for instance, it's going to be slow. You're going to have USB 1.0 probably on a machine that...
Probably 1.1.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. Oh. Okay. All right. Would you recommend continuing to upgrade that laptop, or would you suggest, maybe buying new, or what do you guys think? At what point do you say, hey, listen, this hardware is X years old, when is it time to throw it in the landfill, kind of a thing?
Well, that depends on Richard.
Yeah.
I think that depends on Richard, because I'm sitting right here with a laptop. It's got 192 megabytes of RAM, a 400 megahertz processor, and it's running Windows XP. But that's all
I
wanted
to do. Oh, my gosh. Wow. What does it do?
basically, surf the web. I hand it off to kids or somebody that needs it. I go, here you go. You want to surf the web? Here you go. Try that.
Okay. Well, I'm surprised it even...
Enjoy.
Are you running a screen reader on it?
No, he's not.
Good point.
Yeah.
Good point.
Yeah, that would be...
That tends to make a difference.
Yeah. Okay. Let's go ahead and continue on this discussion with about things on the motherboard. And, do we want to have... everything on the board. Are there advantages and disadvantages to that, or what do you guys think? Go ahead and take it away. We'll start with Ray. Take it away, Ray.
It really kind of depends on your applications. Like, for example, Jeff here, he uses everything he can get his hands on. His motherboard has... let's see. His motherboard has sound on board. It doesn't have video. And then he's got two sound cards in there besides. So... that's what I'm saying. He needs to get everything he can get his hands on. My personal opinion, it depends. If you're just doing stuff on the net, you're not a high-end gamer, that sort of thing, you can probably get away with everything on a motherboard. Although, personally, the only thing I would change out is I wouldn't use the video card on the motherboard. Only as a last resort. And the reason for that is because your video card is going to share some of your RAM memory and use it as its own.
Okay.
So what I would do is just go for us, you can get away with a lower end, PCIe 16 card. And, 40, 50 bucks or thereabouts or 100 bucks or whatever. And you can get away with it just fine. Of course, if you're a gamer, then you're going to want to spend more and get a higher end card.
Yeah.
But otherwise, as far as the sound goes, most of the time it's okay. And then you don't see too often the controllers. You can buy them, the IDE controllers, the network cards. But most times, most of that stuff is sufficient.
Hey Ray, I have a Mitsubishi MR535 hard drive in the closet.
Yeah.
And it's a RLL or MFM drive. Can I buy a controller for that?
Oh, ouch.
You might somewhere. Matter of fact, I think I...
Now that would be cool. I would love to spin that thing up and see if it still works.
Actually, Jeff, in Cleveland, we have a store here called The Graveyard, and that's where parts like that show up.
Unfortunately, I don't think they'd work in a new...
I hear they show up in my closet.
I still have in storage a 20-gig Seagate.
I think I still have an old I think Karen still has an old Arkenstone card or IG-1.
Oh, yeah.
One of those old 1991, 92.
Yeah.
I think I still have an Arctic 215 card around here somewhere.
Yeah,
I may have one of those somewhere, too.
Yeah. Oh, that brings back scary memories for Randy. Doesn't it, Randy?
Yes, it does.
Remembering me calling you.
PC. Yes. We definitely have one of those running around.
Yeah. Actually, those are still quite usable. They're. I don't like the sound of them, but from a synthesizer standpoint, they're fast and.
I used to torment Mr. Randy. So, Randy, what do you think about? And we have a caller. Monty will be with you in just a minute. But what do you think about this issue of putting all things on the motherboard?
I guess for the most part, I don't think about it too much because motherboard manufacturers really don't give you much of a choice. It's rare that you won't find everything from modems to network cards already on the motherboard. Now,
modems?
I think the one to...
Yeah, like
who uses that? Who uses that?
Oh, I
see.
My dad uses one.
I guess for faxing maybe, I don't know.
He dials up to a Peeble PC and does his internet.
There's a lot of places out in the... If you're out in a rural area, there's a lot of places where you're stuck using a modem, so... I've got one in storage, and I've got one in my machine just in case the cable goes down. And then, generally speaking, the cable company will give you a site where you can go and use your modem. So, but that's just for backup.
I am a little bit of a sound snob, personally. So, in machines I build for myself, I always buy a sound card that I want. Both from the point of view of just having decent signal to noise, because I don't like the building cards off the bus. They're generally noisier than cards in a slot. So I'll use a sound card of my choice. And I'll also use a video card because I don't like tying up system resources and
exactly.
Sharing memory. So, but aside from that, I mean, I think the rest of it is fine to be on the motherboard.
I will say one thing about integrated sound. I have integrated sound, and then I also have a Creative Labs Audigy in my system. And the one thing that is good about my integrated sound, which I do not have on my Audigy, is real stereo microphone input.
Well, that depends on the card, though. I mean,
but I'm just saying, surprisingly, it doesn't have what you hear, but it does have the integrated card does have stereo input. So yeah. That's
if you're going to do any serious internet broadcasting, you really don't want to be using the sound on the onboard. I shouldn't say that because.
It depends on what you're doing.
What you're doing,
you know?
Exactly.
I mean, I don't have a mixer and all that stuff.
Yeah. No. I know. Yeah. Right. It all depends on what you're doing. But for example, I can tell. In fact, I could even let you hear it. I can make the.
Wait a minute. Are we supposing that we're doing serious internet broadcasting?
Yeah, well, yeah, that's true. Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah. Yeah, is that what we're doing here?
Yeah, exactly.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, we're getting paid big bucks to do this.
Cool.
Buku bucks.
Yeah,
man,
buku bucks.
Somebody's eating at least.
Hey, I'll order you a pizza after the show.
All right, see, there's witnesses. There's witnesses.
Yeah. Well, you may have already eaten, though. Well, all right, put your order
actually,
in.
Actually, I can testify he does pay off on his pizzas.
Well, sort of. that's a long story. We won't get into that. But
hey, another issue to deal with here, and this is besides the integrated stuff, is where is the stuff located on the board? If you're a blind person and you're buying a brand new board, you don't have a clue where's what. Oftentimes, what I'll do is, it depends. If I'm near a store and I'm going to be buying a board locally, I will ask them, okay, is this bank one, bank zero? And this was going to tell you where this is presuming you have some clue what some things look like the memory slots, and then you ask some questions. Is this IDE 1 or 2? Or on the case of the SATA stuff, which is the first one, then you can't exactly ask all the details, but most of the time the various places for hooking up the lights and the switches are pretty much on the left side toward the bottom of the board if the slots are facing away from you.
Okay. Ray, we'll get to that in just a minute because I want to actually talk to Rick about that because he just got done doing all this.
Yeah.
And it's probably pretty fresh for you there, Rick. But let's bring in Monty. Hello, Monty. How's it going?
Yeah, good evening, everybody. You guys are making me hungry with all this talk of pizza.
Oh, I know. We haven't even, I haven't eaten yet. So, Slick can just come on down, calm down there, because I haven't eaten yet.
I'll get in my private jet and I'll be right down. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
I had an interesting question talking about hardware. And one thing I've always wondered is, my system here that I have is kind of a mid-range system from around mid-2005 or so. And it can take two different types of memory. I think it's like DDR and DDR2. There's like a slot for one and a couple slots for the other. But I don't know what kind of memory is in my machine. All I know is it's got a gig. Is there any piece of software that can probe the board and tell me as a blind person what type of memory I have so that I can maybe try to upgrade this system or
great question.
Buy a new one?
Okay. All right. We'll let you listen on the air. Do you have any other questions?
Thanks. That should do it. You have a good evening.
Okay. Thanks, Monty.
All right. Bye.
All right. Okay, now I actually know the answer to this, but let's toss it over to the Rickster. And Rick, do you know of any software tools that will allow you to determine the type of memory that is in your system?
Bellarc will tell you some things, but I'm not sure if it goes that deep as to what the actual physical memory sticks are in it.
Okay. Now, there's a website, and Ray, you're going to have to help me because I don't remember the manufacturer.
Crucial?
Crucial, yes, thank you.
They
have a tool, and you can go up there, and it's accessible. You can either have it run a wizard, and it will go out and look at your system and go, well, you have... blah, 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 and we'll sell you this. And that's pretty accessible. Or if you know the make and model of your machine, it's a Dell Inspiron 8100 laptop or whatever. Because I bought Crucial Memory for my laptop because it was about a third the price from Dell. and it works. And it works. So,
works fine.
Yeah, it works great. So, head on over there and try it, crucial.com. And I think, Daryl, you going to put that up on the Twitter?
It is already done.
Oh, you're the man.
I'm on the stick.
There you go. All right, Rick. So now on your website, you have listed the new components of your big beast. First of all, let's can we kind of walk through that a little bit and talk about and kind of get people's opinions on why maybe you picked what you picked. We'll start with the board and then go to, you know, the chip and then memory and and go from there, and we'll see what we can learn here. Go ahead.
Okay, where do you want me to start with the board?
Yeah, start there.
Go ahead and start with the board, yeah.
Well, the reason I picked the Gigabyte motherboard that I did is because it's one of the few of the brand newest boards that support the 1333 megahertz Core 2 Duos. It still has PS2 ports. It actually has a COM and an LPT port.
Wow.
And that's unheard of anymore, and I still use my COM port to some extent. So some of the other boards, such as the Intel boards, have no legacy support whatsoever. No floppies, no PS2s, no COMs, no nothing.
Is there advantage to not having the legacy, though? I mean, are you going to get better performance out of a machine that may not have the legacy devices?
No, I don't think you'll necessarily get better performance. It's just
the
new standards are just going away from it, from the legacy support.
Sure. Go ahead, Ray.
Well, in theory, supposedly, there's supposed to be some advantage because you're not using all the various what are called interrupts and all that stuff. But
but that's true.
The other issue, of course, is less components. So, of course, when you're looking at cost building a board, it's a lot cheaper to build without this or that.
Okay.
Definitely.
Okay.
Definitely.
So are there any other reasons that you picked that specific board?
No. The Intel boards, according to people at Newegg, were a bit, the BIOSes were a bit picky. And I don't like the 8-bit boards anymore, and the ASUS boards were just a little too expensive for me. So just kind of went with the Gigabyte. It's a decent board.
Yeah, no,
good
and,
price.
And it is an Intel board, right? I was taking the call, so I kind of missed a little bit.
Yeah, it is.
An Intel board.
Yes, it's an Intel-based board.
Okay. Is it quad?
It's a dual-core.
Dual-core, okay. Okay, Randy, go ahead.
It's a dual-core.
Because I'm curious. I've read about the new dual cores 1333s, and I've also seen the price of quad cores plummet recently. So my question to you: did you consider quad cores, and was there a reason you stayed with a dual?
I considered quad cores, but right now, for the moment, the dual cores seem to be more usable on a system. The quad cores, there's not enough programs floating around out there that really take great advantage of the multi-threading capabilities that, you know, you'd really would have on a quad-core system.
Hmm, interesting. But is there that much software that's taking advantage of dual-core? I mean, if you buy a copy of Office, for example, is it going to know about multiple processors?
If you're a gamer, you do.
Yeah, but
But for a lot of us blind people, of course, the dual core is going to be, as we talked about it earlier, is going to be helpful with reference to a screen reader. So,
but why is that though? Why is that necessarily? I mean, if a screen reader, I mean, if you were to ask the screen reader manufacturers, whether that be GW Micro, Freedom Scientific, whoever, you know, if you were to ask them, are you doing special things to support, you know, hyper threading, for example? I believe you're going to get the answer to be no. Now, I could be mistaken on that, but I don't think that they're doing anything special there. Why is it that we're getting that performance if they're not writing to it?
The reason for that, Jeff, is, I mean, I don't care whether it's GW or JAWS, they're both memory hogs.
Okay, but how does that? But how does
and
that?
So a dual core, and so a dual core is able to. It's like having relays, and you have two people in front of you relaying stuff to another person. You're able to, move that data quicker, and that's where the dual core comes into play.
But is that due to the bus speed, or is that due to the processor?
That's the processor architecture.
Interesting.
Now, the other part of this, which isn't so much for screen readers, but for gamers, is what's called a floating point. And I confess I'm not going to get into that because I don't have all of the knowledge there. But the better the floating point numbers for that processor, it's good for gamers because they use a lot of that stuff.
Sure, sure. Okay.
But I'm confused about the whole issue of gaming as it affects even gaming PCs now, because I've talked to a lot of gamers now who are saying, well, I was going to get a new computer to play my games, but all my games can only be gotten on PlayStation 3 or Xbox, so that's what I'm getting. I mean, what do you guys think that's going to do to that market segment?
Well, let's ask Slick that, because Slick is the game man, or at least he's a lot more of a game man than I am.
I'm not a big gamer. Who's
thanks,
a big
Slick.
Gamer?
Yeah. Well, hey, you're a lot bigger gamer than all of us here.
Yeah, no, I mean, I've looked at it. The reason I'm not a big gamer is because, well, twofold, actually. One, I actually want to have a life.
Oh, that's pretty funny.
I mean, really, I know I got friends that are, yeah, what's that? I know I have friends who play games and they're so into it. And I mean, you know, I don't want to take anything away from them, but I've got other things I want to do. I mean, really. I'm a cheapskate. I don't want to have to spend the money on the platform. Now, I'm leaning towards the PS3, which is probably a different conversation because it's a little bit, as I found out, it's a little bit more flexible in regards to the hardware. But I know Microsoft will probably make an attempt. How serious, I don't know, but they're probably going to make an attempt to move some gaming to the Windows Vista platform.
Well, Halo, for example.
Starting with Halo 3.
Right. Yeah, Halo 3 is out. That just came out only because my kids let me know this, and now they want an Xbox. so we're discussing that one. But they have enough games in this house. Anyway, and Halo 2 is out for the PC. So I think it's – wouldn't you agree, Slick, that it's sort of a delayed reaction, you know, that the games are coming out for, you know, these gaming systems, and then they kind of trickle?
I'm trying to follow where things are going. I just think it goes to one end and then it weighs back those to the other, because I just found out through a study the biggest socializing platform right now is the Xbox 360. It's not computers. It's not like it's the Xbox. They have more people interacting socially on that than any other platform.
Really, like on MySpace and things like that, or what?
More than MySpace.
Really?
Yes,
that's very
we're talking worldwide.
The advantage of the 360, the advantage of the 360 and the Xboxes and the Wiis and all that, is the processors are geared specifically for that type of data for gaming, whereas a standard x86 architecture is more for general use, and then you have to adapt accordingly. So, there are seems like I remember seeing there are programs you can take and copy your, at least I remember my son telling me this, there's a program you can take and copy your CDs from
your
PlayStations
system,
and move
them
over
on
the PCs.
Yeah, there's emulators out there and you can.
Yeah. But then we're getting away really from the whole.
Exactly.
So let's get back on track here. So, where at this point, it's really a choice of from which processor you choose. A few months ago, because I talked to AMD, and AMD, the gentleman I talked to said that this is before the dual core came out. All right, they said even the testing they were aware of from Intel, if you've stuck with the lower end AMD processors, that the AMD would beat them. But when you get up into the higher end stuff like the Xeons and all that, they admitted rather frankly that Intel would wipe them all over the map. So, but that's not quite true anymore. The dual cores, I've been doing a lot of reading since our conversation, Jeff, and it does seem that at this point in time, if you're going to buy a processor, than buy an Intel.
Okay. Yeah.
The there's certainly nothing wrong with AMD. I mean, AMD, you can get a dual core for $60-$70 and do okay with it. And then the Intels, I think, are fairly comparable in prices now, slightly higher from what I've seen.
So you're saying get an Intel because of price, Ray?
No, I think I'd get an Intel because of functionality. I think at this point, the Intel processors, I've been an AMD man for a long time, and I hate to admit it, but the Intel's processor is a better bet.
Yeah, I don't think I've had an Intel in this house for, well, you would know, Ray, how long?
Yeah.
Let me ask you guys a question. There is, at least in some sectors of the blind community anyway, sort of a thinking that that Intel would be better because somehow maybe the AMD processors may be less compatible with screen readers, or there may be more stability issues than with Intel.
No.
Is there anything at all to that?
No.
Not that I'm aware of.
No. The only thing at this point, the Intel with the dual processors, I've read somewhere, I was reading a forum, and they were discussing the AMD, this whole question. And there was an engineer who had piped up and said that the AMD dual cores, every now and then there would be this slight pause, and he didn't have any reason why or, you know, what the deal was, but it would just happen. But I would just go with the Intels now, as far as from a heat standpoint, they've resolved a lot of those issues with
definitely.
Whereas 6 months ago or a year ago, I wouldn't have touched an Intel if you'd have to pay me because of the heat issues.
Exactly.
And the chips, the Intel chipsets have matured a lot too. They were having a lot of problems, with what's called a Prescott chipset, but so that gets a little esoteric. But probably for the average guy out there, I'd just go with an Intel and be done with it.
All right. Well, speaking of Intel, and we've been kind of focusing on the PC side of things, Jesse has joined us, and I know, Jesse, you're on a Mac, aren't you?
Yes, I am. And how's everybody doing tonight, Rick and Ray, and I forgot the other
Randy's
name. Randy and
Darren.
Mr. Chandra over there.
Yep. How can we help you tonight, Jesse?
Okay, well, I had a question and I had a comment about, since you guys were talking over there so much about dual cores and stuff like that. First of all, here's the question, and I bet this is going to stump all of you.
Well, why don't you give us your comment first, and then we'll take your question.
Well,
okay?
The comment is basically what I have. I use a Core Duo processor on my computer, running at 2 gigahertz, and I have run. And I have done this experiment also in Windows and another laptop that I have. And I have run an emulator running basically arcade ROMs, which are really processor intensive. I've been having Skype, Safari, VoiceOver, and a couple other applications. And could you believe that thing hasn't even pulled up the fan to speed it up or anything, and yet I do that in Windows, and that processor is already being worked.
Yeah, well, I have a machine at the office where I think it's going to actually launch from my desk, even when it just boots. So I know what you're saying about a Windows box and fan noise. I mean, you literally can hear it in the hall, and I'm all the way in the back of the room in that office. So
yep, I mean, and I've launched about 8 or 9 applications on the Mac, and
good.
For that fan to kick in, I'd have to be using something like Sound Studio, which is a recording program, for that thing to even kick in.
Okay. All right, and what was your question,
Jesse? My question was, what is the difference between PC MCIA and something that I have now on my Mac called PCI 34? Or I believe that's what my friend told me it was called. And
is this a new laptop, Jesse?
It's one of the latest MacBook Pros with the LED, with the 15-inch LED display.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. Anyone got Google up?
Because a friend of mine was telling me, he told me it was called PC. It looks like a PCMCIA port. You look at this thing, and it looks like a PCMCIA port, but it's not. It's called PC.
Right.
I think it's called PCI Express 34 or PCI 34.
Okay. Well, look
at Express card.
We'll look into this.
Oh, Jeff. Yeah, an Express card.
Okay. And by the way, I don't know if you've seen this, but I've basically, as of today, become a Twitter member.
Yeah. Good. I saw you. Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
And I've been receiving. Actually, I have it set to send me updates about since I'm following the main menu Twitter thing. It actually sends the updates to my phone.
Now, which phone? I know it's a little bit off topic, but which phone are you on now?
No, that's good that you're asking me that, Jeff, because I heard you, and I did hear the report about Mobile Speak going to that new license scheme,
yeah,
which I love a lot. They're finally doing something right. I have the Samsung Blackjack.
Yeah, see,
I don't
like the Blackjack.
What, because of the QWERTY keyboard?
Well, I just don't think it's really... Like, there's no dots on the F and the J on the QWERTY keyboard?
Well, you could do what a friend of mine did, but except you're going to end up paying about $500 for MobileSpeak, and that is getting something like the 8125, which is their pocket PC.
Well, I'll tell you what, we'll take this offline,
okay.
I'll talk to you about it.
But good luck with the program, guys, and... I just wanted to ask you guys that because I didn't really know the difference.
Okay, well, we'll see if we jump up an answer for you on that.
All right, buddy.
Okay, buddy.
All right, and have a good time, guys.
We'll talk to you later.
All right.
Bye, Jesse. 866-400-5333. 866-400-JEFF, if you would like to participate in the show. And let's see, does anyone have an answer to that? I have not heard of these types of cards.
ExpressCard.org. I think I had my first experience with this when Alienware sent me that new gaming laptop a couple of weeks ago.
Okay.
And I looked at the slot on the side, and I was like, what is this? And then I had to go do some reading on it. But it's the newest thing.
Okay. So is it compatible with the older PCMCIA slots?
Oh, no.
No. Okay.
No way.
Okay. Okay. So it's a
whole different
great.
Slot totally technology. Different.
Oh, great. Okay. Oh, good. More money.
The Windows issue versus Mac that he pointed out, Microsoft just loves to waste memory, and that's a lot of it. It's how XP actually does a pretty decent job of using memory, but there's a lot of areas where a lot of background stuff that you don't need, and there are programs out there to analyze that. To where you can turn a lot of that off and also change some Windows settings to best performance versus let Windows use what it thinks it wants. And things like that, that'll help.
Yeah, great.
You guys.
Hey, guys, I wanted to ask you something, too, that Jesse brought up, and because I'm kind of new. I mean, the biggest thing I'm aware of is JAWS that I've known for years. But so, like I said, I was trying out this new MacBook this week, and I stumbled across something, VoiceOver, which Jesse mentioned. what's your opinion of it? Because I haven't fired it up yet, but I was surprised to find it. I was like, really? I mean, do you guys like the accessibility features on the MacBook?
All right, I'll go.
I don't have enough experience to be able to answer that.
Me neither.
I don't like it because now one could argue that I've used Windows and dare I say DOS-based screen readers so long that I'm a little bit jaded by their command sets, but to work VoiceOver, some of the keystrokes are three and four key sequences, which I find awkward. And I know that from a training perspective, even when you get into a three key sequence, you get a lot of users that have issues. And then you add that fourth key, and it's going to be a long day at the office. So the other thing that I don't like about it is that while it has some good ideas, it's almost to me like a lab piece, because the reader doesn't support very many third party applications. And when you take the issue to Apple, their response is, well, you need to lobby the vendor. And get the vendor to come around, and they'll have this clairvoyant moment, and then they'll, you know, they'll make their stuff accessible. Well, all of us have lived that with Microsoft already.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, and well, so I don't think we're really into reinventing the railroad.
Well, it's very
the only reason Apple even did it, you know, at least in my opinion, you know, Steve Jobs could care less about accessibility. The only reason he put VoiceOver into the Mac is because of 508, and they didn't want to lose their education contracts.
Well, I do think we need to be careful on what we think Steve Jobs' opinion is, but look, they're advanced.
That's my opinion.
I understand, but you have to look at where the next Leopard, I think, is headed. They're adding Braille display support into the Mac, and supposedly there's going to be a lot more enhancements to VoiceOver. Go ahead, Daryl.
I just said I think it's great that there's an integrated screen reader. You know, the VoiceOver is there for everyone, and it actually sort of, you know, could raise some awareness of accessibility as well.
Yep.
But I'm concerned that, you know, you've got to have, in order for a screen reader to be worth its weight, you got to have applications that work with it, and I'm just not seeing the applications, even from Apple. I mean, it's only recently that iTunes has been accessible.
I think what we need. I think what we need to do is we need to revisit this whole discussion about
different time.
About the Mac, and I think it would be good to get a few people to come on to talk about, you know, that are Macintosh users. Get Jesse. Maybe we can get Darcy and Holly to come back, as well as a number of others. And I know there's actually a Macintosh users group
Mac Visionaries.
Yeah, and maybe we can get some representatives from them to come on and kind of, you know, we haven't talked about this for months, and it would be good to kind of revisit it. I mean, the landscape is changing, especially with Leopard coming around. So we have a caller. They say they have a comment for us. Hello, caller, and welcome to Main Menu Live.
Yes, hi. This is Michelle from New Jersey.
Hi.
And my comment is, a little while ago in the discussion, you were talking about how long having a computer, and I have to say I have my computer, thanks to Randy, for about 5 years, still going strong. And one of the lessons he taught me 5 years ago in helped me put this computer together,
mm-hmm.
It says put your money into a good motherboard, a good chip, and a good hard drive, and she's still running.
So I just wanted
to make a comment on that it's true. I have friends who got Dell systems 2 years ago, and they're having problems. They had to have it rebuilt. They had all kinds of trouble, and I said, guys, I'm still chucking along here with my baby from 5 years ago.
That's right. So the real message here is buy real quality, and you'll have a machine that's going to last you, right?
Yes. You got it. And that's lesson I learned from Randy.
All right. Do you have any other questions for us?
Good to hear from you.
Oh, no, but I do for Randy off the line.
Okay. Well, why don't you give him I'm sure you have his number. You can give him a call. All right.
Okay. Thanks to you all.
And good night.
There is this.
We have,
go ahead, Daryl.
We have a question on MSN to handle after this particular discussion thread.
Okay. Well, I think it's a good time to ask it.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Oh, okay. Josh asks, he has a Windows XP machine that's running a little slow. He's like, what is a good program to easily find, to easily determine and turn off unneeded programs running in the background?
Oh, you know, let's let Slick and Ray handle this, because this is and I'm sure Rick can throw in some things too, as well as Randy, but this really kind of falls directly into their troubleshooting skill set. only because the only reason I know this is because I worked with them in this type of capacity extensively. So let's let you take it first, Slick. If you have a machine that is running at turtleneck speed, what kind of things would you look at?
Well, I usually, for me, the usual suspects would be, let's see, I'm trying to whittle down my list for the conversation.
Yeah, right, yeah.
I'm gonna recommend, and you guys have to tell me if they're accessible, because I don't know. AdAware, SpyBot. And the reason I recommend SpyBot is mainly because there's a startup section in there where I know a lot of people can just go in and check stuff.
But this is safer-networking.org, right, for SpyBot?
I think so.
Yes.
I don't remember. I usually just do a search for it and go for it.
Yeah,
unfortunately, it's not real accessible.
Well, SpyBot is.
It's not.
It might be better now, but
SpyBot's pretty good.
I think SpyBot's always been reasonably accessible. Yeah.
Now the new AdAware is the new AdAware version 7, I believe. Now, Rick, is that still pretty? I haven't kept up on that one. Have you heard whether or not they've made...
From what I am hearing, it's not very accessible at
okay,
all.
Well, I knew they were going to be working on it, so I wasn't sure if... I think I have about 4,000 emails in my blind tech folder, so I haven't...
I was told the new Zone Alarm suite, they put in a lot of the hooks to make things more accessible. At least that's what the lady told me when I asked her on one of the local computer shows.
Oh, that's interesting. Has anyone had any experience?
But I haven't played with it yet, no.
Yeah, I haven't either. Have you, Randy or Rick?
But
I used to use Zone Alarm religiously when I could see, but it's not accessible. So
yeah, not now, right? Okay, all right. Let's continue.
Yeah.
Yeah, but okay. Yeah, and it is. You're right. It's safer-networking.org is the site for a SpyBot. Outside of that, I go straight for. I don't recommend anything else other than let's take a look at your run keys. I mean, honestly.
And what tools would you run
keys? Registry.
Run keys.
Yeah.
Yeah. What tool? I mean, you don't want really people hacking around in the registry necessarily.
No, I don't. That's why I shut my mouth after I said that.
Yeah.
Let's deal with it from a different perspective here, Slick. Why not? Besides the AdAware, you can always the general stuff check to make sure your Internet Explorer you've emptied out its cache. Go in to, of course, your virus. You want to make sure you don't have any viruses because those can do all kinds of wonders. Mm-hmm. The other factor, a lot of people suggest msconfig. You can go in and turn some of that stuff off. I would be careful because
Ray, do you and I have two different views on the use of msconfig?
No, actually,
I don't know if we ever really had that conversation.
No, actually, if it is what some people think it's a good idea to use, I think it's a good test tool to figure out where a problem is. But there are other programs.
Thank you.
Yeah, but there are other programs like what was it, CyberCop, I think. Where it'll go in and look for things, and you can turn off stuff. That's a good place to start.
I can tell you one lady who really loves msconfig. That's Kim Commando, and that drives me nuts. But
yeah.
She just every time she tells somebody, "Oh, just go on msconfig and turn it off," I just want to drive up to Phoenix and slap her. I really do.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
Well, you got to remember something with Microsoft, and I'm presuming this might be with Mac also, but Microsoft doesn't do anything unless it's market-driven. That's a little secret that I learned, and we both learned that. And a lot of the applications that are in Microsoft, like Notepad, what's the word? WordPad, well, even MSConfig, Paint, they're there mainly for testing purposes. That's what they're there for. Not so much for to be a usable. So that's something to remember. But the other factor too is how much memory do you have for your system? if you're running a computer with, let's say, a P3 with 128 megs of RAM, which in my last job, that's what they were running, and running XP, of course, it was slow. So you got to have at least 256 megs of RAM, at least. These days...
Well, 1 gig at least.
Well, it depends for the applications. If you're just surfing the web and that kind of stuff, yeah, you can get away with it. But if you're running...
And if you're running Windows Vista, for example.
Well, no. That's different. But if you're running XP and you're running stuff, Word and all that stuff...
5 good on XP.
Then you got to have at least 5 to 1 meg. And it's cheap now. Memory's cheap.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, no, I agree with Ray. I mean, it's like going to see a doctor for a physical. I mean, it's more to, I don't feel good here, take this pill. It's, well, what did you eat, and are you exercising? I mean, it's everything that comes into play.
Yeah, how long have you been running the current installation of XP on the system?
Yeah, that brings up a good point. How often are you guys, what's your opinion on that? I mean, do you scrub your system every year or so? Or
Every couple. Hey, one thing that is good, and I know a lot of people use this application, but let me see now. I just had it. It's part of Microsoft Office. It's FindFast.
Oh, FindFast, huh?
Get rid of it.
Yeah.
Get rid of it because it's
OSA.exe, right?
Yeah. Well, you can turn it off in Control Panel, I think. But the reason why is it's a memory leaker. In other words, it will take. You'll begin to wonder where your resources are going after a while, and you start looking around, and this program's, it's like letting air out of your tires.
But I'm wondering if that's still an issue, say, in the latest service packs of 2003.
Well, when the last I was there, and I even asked a Microsoft tech, is FindFast still an issue, even in 2003? And they said, yeah. Okay. You know, it was sort of off the record, but
I don't even know if it exists in Office 2007 because the Windows Live search component is a requirement of Office 2007 when you install it.
Yeah.
So you don't really have a choice there. Of course, with Vista, you get that automatically. With XP, they basically mandate it and make you download it.
And as far as systems, how long to keep your computer? Well, once again, that's sort of up to you.
Yeah.
I know my sister-in-law still has an old P4 Dell, and of course it's in an office environment. She's just she handles some apartments, and that's all she does it for. It's fine for that.
Yeah. We had a question from Steve. This is talking about cooling. And I've had some issues with cooling in the past, and he wants to know how many fans are really required in a machine, and really is more better necessarily, and when does one consider maybe going to a water coolant type system, which I don't even want to talk about leaky things around here. I've had enough of that this year.
Unless you're a hardcore gamer that believes in overclocking processes beyond healthy limits, I don't think you need to go to water cooling.
No, I agree.
You know, that's excessive. And as far as the fans are concerned, I think part of it is the characteristics of the processor you use, and part of it is the design of your case. Because some cases are really set up to dissipate heat well, may not need as many fans as other cases where that's not the case.
And another thing with fans is, and a lot of people don't understand, is, you know, you have to balance, you know, intake with outflow. Mm-hmm. If you push too much air into the system, you put too much pressure inside the system, and you're not, you know, getting enough outflow, then you're not moving air.
Interesting.
So, you know, it's real important to, you know.
Now I've heard of there are a number of software tools that can apparently tell you the temperature inside your system. Does anybody have any ideas on which ones of those would be accessible, and are they really worth testing?
Yeah, they're good.
Some of them are. I know.
Some of them.
I know. I ran when, as a matter of fact, my wife still has her old AMD XP processor with the NVIDIA chipset, and it has a hardware doctor. It's accessible. You have to use a JAWS cursor to read the info, but it's quite accessible that way.
What have you used, Rick?
I use a program called SpeedFan.
Okay.
It's reasonably accessible.
SpeedFan.com, right?
I'm not sure.
We'll get that.
And it's pretty accessible. Yeah. Do you use the JAWS cursor, or is it?
You have to use the JAWS cursor some, but it's nice. It's down in the system tray, and it'll.
Oh, nice.
It'll read your temps. It's pretty good.
Oh, good.
But these things are only as good as your motherboard and the temperature sensors. If you know, if the motherboards use poor temperature sensors, and then you know they're not worth a hill of beans, because if the temperatures are wrong and they're notorious for being wrong, then you know it does you no good to get a false sense of security.
All right.
I had a computer in a lab that routinely would shut down because of a poor temperature sensor. It wasn't hot in there at all. It just thought it was.
Mm-hmm. Nice. Now, what about batteries in systems? Is that really as much of an issue anymore? Or
Not anymore. No. It used to be on the old 386s and 486s. I would routinely take those out and switch them over to a external battery, because at that time, they'd have these little 3-volt or 1-volt batteries, and it was there to support the BIOS, and oftentimes they wouldn't hold their values. So at that time, so then you switch out to a 6-volt battery, and it was fine. But anymore, that's not even an issue now.
Interesting. All right. Well, and one other question that someone has emailed us in, this is actually from a number of weeks ago, but I wanted to get your guys' opinion on this. What do you guys feel are things that are not really capable for a blind person to be not doing in reference to building a system?
I'm not sure how to answer that.
Well, I mean, I can think of a number of
things. Depends on your skill level.
Yeah.
Well, let's assume that you're pretty hardware savvy. Are there, for example, he brought up things like putting on the grease for the actual CPU. Is that something that a blind person should be doing?
Sure.
Okay. Because this person
depends on your skill level.
Yeah.
Right.
It really
does. Okay. And is there?
I don't see that as.
Now, I would say, I know there used to be situations with power connectors and drive cables and things that were not keyed that shouldn't be done by a blind person, because you have no way to know how those are connected.
Right. Is that an issue anymore?
No.
No. Okay.
No.
Now, hard drive and,
yeah, what about wiring, like master-slave and jumpers?
That's still a
thing of the past now.
Yeah, with serial ATA, you don't deal with that.
My system has none of it.
Really?
Yeah, with ATA, that's true.
Nope.
You don't.
But plug the drives in and go on your merry way.
Yeah, really? Well, exactly, we're doing that next.
And most new systems don't care about the placement of RAM, which banks to some extent. They don't care so much about what, say, on SATA, which controller you're plugged into.
That latter is true, but the former, I'm going to slightly disagree, because if you have a machine that is a
if you're dual channel, you
dual
need to
channel,
know.
Yes, that's where that comes into play.
What about CD-ROM drives or DVD drives? You know, getting them on the right channel has also proven to be somewhat of an issue in reference to performance.
Well, but some of those. There's a couple of DVD drives now that are serial ATA. So, again, if you get one of those, that's a non-issue.
That's a non-issue.
Yeah,
but
that's
if you're,
what I have.
But if you're still dealing with the IDE stuff, where you're paying, like, and I don't know how much the cost on the solder drives are, but like I said, when you can go buy a standard light-on drive, for example, for $35 and stick it in there, then
you can buy
you,
the serial ATA just same price.
Same price,
really?
That's good to know.
Really interesting. Yeah. Okay.
That's what I paid for mine.
Now, what about wiring? We're almost out of time here, so I just want to make sure we get to all these. But what about wiring, lights, and other type of wiring issues on the board? How comfortable do you feel about doing that, Rick?
Well, the front panel, you may need some sighted assistance to get the lights. The lights, the LEDs have to be wired correctly or they won't light.
Yeah.
They won't light.
Now, there's no issue there if you do wire them backwards, right? You're not
no,
going to short
just, something
they
just out won't or, work.
No, okay. They just won't light.
Okay, good. All right, well, any other last comments you guys want to recommend in reference to those that are you know, potentially wanting to get their hands dirty into the game of hardware? And let's start with Ray, and then we'll go to Randy, Rick, and then you, Slick.
We kind of covered cases a little bit, but you've got to make sure, and you want to look in the reviews and see what people say about how well built the case is. I mean, some of these cases, you just tap them and they break. Okay. And then there are others where they're fairly well built, and it's a cost issue too. You can spend a couple hundred dollars for the aluminum case. Well, I'm exaggerating, but you can spend a high price for the aluminum cases. But if you stick to some of the steel cases, you still have to look into how well they're built, how do they handle airflow, like we were talking earlier. That's definitely important. You can kind of get away with it on the newer processors. You don't have to be quite as concerned because of the heating issues, but it still is a concern.
Okay. And Randy?
A concern that I see a lot in computers, that the part that fails most often that we deal with in repairing computers for our consumers is our power supplies in computers. When you're looking at cases, oftentimes your low end or your mid level cases come bundled with a power supply, but not all power supplies are created equal, and not all power supplies deliver what they say they do.
Okay.
I'm a really firm believer in making certain that your system is not underpowered, and that the power supply really delivers. And I think where possible, and I know that I may get some static here in terms of cost value, but I think it makes sense to buy your supply in addition to your case, so you have control over the manufacturer of the supply and the way in which it behaves.
Good job. Okay, Rick?
Well, quality, quality, quality.
Yeah.
Okay.
Too many people feel that a piece is a piece is a piece.
Gotcha. Okay.
And, you know, do your research and make sure you know what you're buying. Like Randy said, you know, I looked long and hard for a good power supply.
All right.
And the ones that come in the cases generally are no good.
Okay.
And it'll kill your system real fast.
Yeah, I hear you. Okay, Slick.
All right, I like the approach of Hannibal of the A-Team, the leader. I love it when a good plan comes together. Research, research, research. Take your time. Don't rush. Give yourself a day to think about it, you know, about regards to putting it together, a day to think about it, a day to do it, and a day to clean up the mistakes. Shot as early as possible. I mean, plan for the worst. Plan that you're going to plug the wrong thing in the wrong thing, and you're going to have to take it back and get a replacement. I mean, just have a good plan.
Absolutely. Okay. And Daryl.
Well, I just echo what everyone else has said, and I think this is has been a great experience for all of us. I can quickly share a story where when you're installing RAM, make sure everything is clean, make sure there's not a piece of dust or something in the RAM slot.
Yeah.
I had candle-sized flames coming out of my computer.
Yeah.
It was pretty spectacular.
Good stuff.
Wow.
So that was lots of fun.
Absolutely.
That's scary.
Well, I want to thank all of you for being here tonight, and we really do appreciate that. We're coming up to the top of the hour, so we got to get out of here and make room for our next presenters.
Are we
going to
do any contacts?
I'll tell you what, we do not have time to give everybody that. What we will do is we'll put them in the show notes for those of you who are willing to give out personal details on how to get in touch with you. And we'll talk with all of you about that in just a minute, if you could just hang on.
All right.
Coming up next week on Main Menu, we're going to be hearing all about what happened at Site Village. That's right, Site Village presentations will be coming up. That's going to be brought to us by our archivist here on ACB Radio Mainstream and Interactive and all the other stuff. So he has a lot of content for us that we're going to bring to you next week here on Main Menu Live. We'll see all of you next week. And if you have any comments or suggestions, get to us by emailing mainmenu@acbradio.org. We'll see all of you next week.
If you would like to contact the Main Menu production team or panel of experts heard this evening on Main Menu Live, then simply send an email to mainmenu@acbradio.org. That's mainmenu@acbradio.org. If you have suggestions for topics or you have questions that you would like to have addressed on a future edition of Main Menu Live, then email us and we'll do what we can to answer them or cover your suggested topics on a future Main Menu Live. Thanks for listening, and we hope you'll join us next week on ACB Radio Mainstream for another Main Menu Live.